Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hey guys, welcome back to Storytime Slayer Podcast. Today I'm going to talk to you about a very strange case. We're going to talk about 19-year-old Brittany Wood's missing person case. So Brittany's been missing since May of 2012 after last being seen with her uncle Donnie. Unfortunately, Donnie suffered a gunshot wound that rendered him brain dead, and he died without telling anyone what he knew about the disappearance of Brittany. Brittany's missing person case became a media sensation. She was a beautiful, petite, young, white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman. Then an already pending investigation into Brittany's family uncovered one of the largest child pedophile rings in Alabama history. I want to talk about the story because I became obsessed with this case and wanted to break it down for anybody else as interested in it as I am. I anticipate a lot of people who are already obsessed with this case are going to listen, but what I'm going to do is give you a brief outline of events so anyone unfamiliar doesn't get confused, and then we're going to pick it apart. Before I get started, I just want to thank you so much for tuning into Storytime Slayer Podcast. I'm your hostess, Haley Lira. Of course, anything pertaining to these cases, I post on my Facebook, Storytime Slayer. I would love a like and follow and share. I also post on Insta, story_time_slayer. I'm just one of those people, though. I Facebook way more than Insta. I don't have an Instagram-worthy life. So with that being said, go on, leave me a 5-star review if you don't mind. I know honesty is always the best policy, but 5 stars sounds pretty honest to me. And let's dive in because we have so much to talk about today. And when I say buckle up, you guys, like, I'm not kidding. We need race car seatbelts in this car, okay? This case has a lot of information. That's why it's broken down into 2 parts. It's not really about the length. It's about how much information there is to process and absorb. So part one are the events leading up to Brittany being missing and some of the backstory with her family, along with her uncle's weird death. And then part two, we're going to go into the missing person case and the family sex crimes in chronological order. So that way we can see how everything intertwines. This is the best way I could think to do it. So yes, let's jump in. First, I want to introduce you to everyone. So we have Randall Wood, who goes by the nickname Scott, and he was in his mid-40s when all of this happened. We have Chassie Wood, who was 40 or 41, and she is the mother to Brittany Wood, Derek Wood, TJ Wood, and then she has 2 younger children that she has with her husband, Paul. Brittany was 19, Derek was like 22, TJ was close to 17, that's a guess, and her last 2 kids were both under the age of 3 when Brittany went missing. Mindy and Wendy Wood are twin sisters. They're in their early 30s, and during this case, Wendy is married to a man named Donnie Holland. If I'm not mistaken, they have 2 children together, 2 sons, and I believe Donnie's daughter, who I won't refer to by name, I'm just going to call her Dee. She was Wendy's stepdaughter. She was like 16 or 17 when everything blew up, and her brothers were probably 9 and 7. Donnie and Wendy are considered the ringleaders of all these crimes we're going to discuss. Now, Donnie did have other children, but they were grown or not living in the home. So in relation to this case, we have Donnie, Wendy, and their 3 kids. Mindy, Wendy's twin, is married to Dustin Kent, who is just a couple years older than Mindy, making him in his mid-30s when all this happened. Jennifer Moore is an important aspect to this case, but she's not related. She's closely involved, though, because she was best friends with Wendy and participated in her heinous crimes. Jennifer was 32 when all this went down. Just to clarify, Scott, Mindy, Wendy, and Chassie are all siblings. They have other siblings, but we don't need to worry about those ones for this case. This would make Scott, Mindy, and Wendy Brittany's uncles and aunts. Okay, Chassie's Brittany's mom. All right, let's pull forward. Everyone else, I'll fill you in when we get to them. We're going to start with the family's lifestyle and Brittany Wood's life before we continue. This family struggles with a lot of issues common in areas with such low socioeconomic status. To put it in perspective, in 2012, the national poverty rate was between 12 and 15%. And in Mobile, Alabama, where the Wood family lived, that was at a 15% poverty rate, which had actually dropped since the year prior. The year before these crimes, it was at a 17% poverty rate. As of 2021, that national poverty rate dropped to 11%. And in Mobile County, Alabama, where Brittany lived, and much of her close family still do, the poverty rate is back up to 17%. this is my own judgment, but the Wood family is broke, okay? They're country people. One might use the term redneck. Not that I think there's anything wrong with that. I've actually lived in similar conditions and had a lifestyle similar to the Wood family with my high school sweetheart. So I'm not above it. There are some implications of substance abuse issues throughout the family tree. It would not surprise me if that was true. They seem like they meth around a little bit. They also aren't very educated. I know Brittany dropped out of school at 14, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was a common trend in her family. They aren't stupid, they just aren't educated. So in her late teens, Brittany gets into drugs and starts a very toxic relationship with a guy her age named Andy Hamilton. The couple fought all the time. And Andy even admits that he was a young piece of shit at the time who did put his hands on her. I'm going to go out on a limb and say they were probably mixed up in drugs and alcohol and unhealthy surroundings. Then Brittany got pregnant at 16. Actually, fun fact, Brittany and her mom were pregnant at the same time and delivered their babies within a week of each other. Brittany was 17 when she gave birth to Peyton. Andy and her ultimately broke up, but he did get a paternity test and stepped up as a father to Peyton. And he seemed to be a real dad, not a weekend dad. In the Peacock documentary, Brittany's family paints her as a loving and doting mom. And I am sure Brittany did the best she could given her family and life circumstances. But the truth is, Brittany had begun abusing drugs and living in a rather chaotic life, bouncing from place to place and sometimes not being heard of for days at a time. Often she had family help care for her daughter. Peyton's dad, Andy, lived with his grandparents. And in 2011, Brittany gave up custody of Peyton and Andy was ultimately granted full custody in 2012. So I hope some of this background helps you see the full picture as we dive into this story. Here's the synopsis so you don't get stuck or lost on any one thing as we unpack this long web of chaos. That's what it's going to be. Donnie shoots himself June 1st around 2 p.m. That's Wendy's husband. His death was initially ruled a suicide, heavily debated though. After 2 days of trying to get in touch with Brittany to tell her about her Uncle Donnie, Chassie, Brittany's mom, finds out Brittany had been with her Uncle Donnie the last time she was seen, and she has since seemed to fall off the face of the earth. No calls, texts, or Facebook posts. So it wasn't until after Donnie's death that anyone knew Brittany was missing. A huge media campaign is headed up by Chassie to try and find Brittany. In the middle of her search efforts, a huge child pedophilia ring is exposed and arrests were made. This took all the media attention away from finding Brittany. The craziest part of all is the people who were arrested in the pedophilia ring were directly related to Brittany, including her mom. So Wendy, Mindy, Donnie, Kent, Scott, and Wendy's friend Jennifer, Brittany's brother Derek, and mother Chassie were arrested, as well as Donnie's son Donnie Jr. and another family friend William Brownlee in connection to this pedophilia ring. Whew! We're going to start at the very beginning. I don't have an exact month and year, probably April or May of 2011, Scott Wood got a new job. Scott had not lived in Alabama, so he called his sister Wendy and asked if he could come stay with her so he could start this new job. She said yes, so he does that. He moves in with Wendy, her husband Donnie, and their three kids. According to Scott's sister Chassie, Scott started to get suspicious of Wendy and Donnie's activities, though, after he moved in. They do not elaborate on what made Scott suspicious of them, what he was seeing, hearing, or feeling. It for sure involved sexual abuse of minors. So while staying there and becoming suspicious, Scott saw a sexually explicit message on Donnie and Wendy's daughter's computer. The girl was only 15, and the message indicated sexual relationships were happening between her and an adult. At first, Scott tried to report the abuse to anonymous hotlines, but nothing happened. So he ultimately made the decision to report the abuse directly to the police department February of 2012. This launched an investigation into suspicious activities Scott reported at Wendy and Donnie Holland's home March of 2012. Donnie had to move out of the family home, which was located off Bay Street in Fairhope, Alabama, and he moved to a property near Styx River that family friend Jennifer Moore owned and allowed Donnie to live at. Jennifer didn't live there. It was an extra property she had. Because of the accusations against Donnie and sexual abuse of minors, he wasn't allowed to live at home or be around any minors. So he's staying at Styx River Bay Street is in Fairhope. It's about 40 to 45 minutes away from the Styx River property. Styx River is an actual river, and the area people are referring to as Styx River in Alabama is the part of the stream that's pilotable, meaning you can ride something down the river there, tubes, kayaks, floats, that sort of thing. Now, this is where things get a bit confusing. At first, Scott's sister, Chassie, said she had no idea of any sexual abuse or investigation involving Wendy and Donnie when everything went down. But in other interviews, Chassie said that when the investigation began, this is all prior to Brittany going missing, Scott called her and told her the police would be going to Donnie's house for an investigation and asked if he could stay with her. She said yes, and according to Chassie, her and Scott sat in the living room for 3 days straight doing nothing but talking. They didn't eat, they didn't sleep, they didn't drink, they just sat and talked the entire time about everything that Scott uncovered at Donnie's house. Wow, no food, drinks, or sleep. They were not messing around, y'all. Scott told Chassie that he'd been doing his own private investigation for several months at Donnie and Wendy's, and he uncovered an awful incestual pedophilia ring involving their siblings, some family friends, and several minors, all in relation to them. Well, I don't know if all the victims were related to them or not, but a lot, if not all, the children victims were related in this family. Some of the abusers had actually been victimized as children and then turned into abusers that participate in this behavior with the adults that once molested and abused them. We're talking about 3 generations of sexual abuse. Sick, sick, sick. My main takeaway from that is one time Chassie said she had no idea of any sort of sexual abuse before the arrest started happening. And then another time she made it clear her brother moved in and told her before the arrest. So I don't know. We have a lot to talk about. Remember that. And we're going to move forward. The police began a formal investigation into the claims against Donnie and Wendy Hall in March 2012. Donnie answered questions on several occasions, in person and over the phone, and even agreed to a polygraph test, which he failed miserably. Donnie had a formal interview scheduled for June 1st at 2:30, where he was probably going to be arrested, and he likely knew that. During the investigation into Donnie, 19-year-old Brittany Woods was contacted by police and asked if she would agree to talk to them in relation to the investigation into her uncle. According to Eric Winberg, a former detective for the Baldwin County Sheriff's Department who was heavily involved in investigating this, we're going to be discussing, not only did he say police got in touch with Brittany, he said over text message she confirmed she was willing to speak with them. According to the Peacock documentary, Brittany would have potentially been the investigator's key to easily unlocking this pedophilia ring and prosecuting all those involved to the full extent of the law if she was willing to talk. So she would be a key witness against them all. Around the same time this investigation is happening, rumors in the Wood family begin circulating that Donnie's daughter Dee was raped by a family member while Donnie watched. So May 27th, 2010, Dee actually messaged Brittany and was like, hey, what's up, cuz, or something like that. And Brittany asked her point blank, what's going on with these rumors? Dee told Brittany that she had been raped by her Uncle Scott and Uncle Dustin while her dad watched. Dee also said in the messages to Brittany that she told on her dad for what happened. March 28th and 29th, Dee messaged Brittany a couple times, but she never got a response back. The following day, March 30th, Brittany had been hanging out at her mom's house that day. Brittany spent a lot of time on her phone and on Facebook, which isn't unusual at all for her age and for the time period. She made several calls to her mom, friends, and her uncle Donnie during the day. Around 7:20, Brittany got her bag together and she left her mom's, telling Chassie she was going to her friend Chelsea's house. Remember, Britt did not actually live at her mom's. She came and went as she pleased. Her mom said bye and watched her walk to the end of the road to be picked up. According to Chassie, though, the spot Brittany got picked up from was behind a fence in a bush, so she didn't actually see who picked Brittany up. She just saw her go to that area. Chassie's house was off Leonard Drive in Mobile, Alabama. Brittany, however, did not get a ride to her friend Chelsea's, nor did she have any intention of going there. Brittany got picked up by her uncle Donnie at 7:20, likely to confront him about the rape of his daughter and this incestual child abuse ring. Brittany was spotted shortly after being picked up by Donnie at a place called Tillman's Corner. Tillman's Corner intersects at Carroll Plantation Road and Old Pascagoula Road. It has a gas station on the corner, so they probably stopped there for gas or cigarettes or a drink, whatever. But this is the last time Brittany is seen alive. What Brittany likely didn't know is that at 7 o'clock that same day, her Aunt Wendy had an interview with Detective Winberg at Wendy's home in Fairhope. Things looked to be closing in on Wendy and Donnie. This means Brittany was putting herself in a very dangerous situation. Brittany maybe knew she was in danger, though, because friends close to Brittany said that she'd recently gotten a gun to protect herself. No one knew what she needed to protect herself from specifically, though. Later, they will learn. We can tell by Brittany and Donnie's cell phone records that they were both at the Styx River property by 8:25 that evening and remained there. Brittany had been texting consistently from the time she left her mom's at 7:20 until 10:45 p.m., and then at 11:20, she sent two outgoing texts placing her still at the Styx River property. Shortly after those last two texts were sent, though, Brittany quit using her phone. She ultimately received 14 missed calls between 11:29 and 11:45. They were all from her baby daddy, Andy, who left her two voicemails. What those voicemails say, I don't know. We don't know because Brittany's voicemail was checked at 12:07 a.m. May 31st, which is 21 minutes after Andy's phone calls. It's unknown if Brittany checked the voicemails or if somebody else did. Sometime between 8:20 and midnight, the night that Brittany went to Styx River with her uncle, Wendy went to the Styx River property also to visit her husband. I think it was probably closer to 10:45 and midnight that Wendy was there, though, because according to Donnie's cell phone records, he spoke to Wendy three times on the phone between 8:36 and 10:33 for 10 to 20 minutes at a time. Nobody calls each other when they're together in the middle of nowhere. We know Donnie left Styx River at 12:27 and was driving because his cell phone starts pinging off of different towers, showing him headed toward Mobile, Alabama. So let's make this simpler. Mobile, Alabama is on the left-hand side of Mobile Bay, and that's where Chassie, Scott, Mindy, and Dustin all live, while Donnie, Wendy, and Jennifer all live on the right-hand side of Mobile Bay. I assume Wendy was no longer with Donnie at this time because it shows that he got a call from her at 12:30. So Johnny's driving to Mobile, Alabama. At 1:08, he gets a text pinging him at Leonard Drive's cell tower. Important piece. Leonard Drive is a street that Chassie lives on, and the cell phone tower is quite literally right in front of that house. But her sister, Mindy, and Mindy's husband, Kent, live literally like just right around the corner from Chassie. So if Donnie went to Chassie's or Mindy's, it would have hit the same cell phone tower. I think it's much more likely that Donnie went to Mindy's, and we'll talk about that. You'll see why. Wendy and Mindy are extremely close. I mean, obviously, they're twins. At 1:28, Donnie called Wendy, and his location was reported still near the Leonard Drive cell phone tower. That would be the last cell phone activity for Donnie until 8:30 a.m., May 31st, where he was back at Styx River. As for Wendy, we know that she was home at least by 1:42 a.m. because she made a Facebook post. And as for Brittany, the only activity her phone had since her voicemail was checked at 12:07 was at 1:47 when a text was sent from her phone. It showed her location to be at a cell phone tower off exit 4 in Grand Bay, Alabama. This looks to be the location of a truck stop. There's a lot of speculation about the cell phone ding and whether or not it was a repeat text. A repeat text is when your phone doesn't have service, so the text doesn't go through. And then when your phone regains service, your phone will automatically try to resend the text message on its own. A lot of people have dismissed this being a repeat text on multiple occasions, especially law enforcement, because a cell phone doesn't try to resend a text message hours later. I disagree with this, though. I think the text was being sent when Brittany's phone was powered off, possibly, and if the phone was turned back on at 1:47 by whoever had it, the text would have maybe tried to resend on its own, causing this to ping at exit 4. It is very possible for Donnie to have left Leonard Drive area and made it to exit 4 by 1:47. And by the way, Donnie was a truck driver, which makes me think he was really comfortable and familiar with the truck stop off exit 4, and maybe he even had a trucker friend who could assist him with disposing of whatever he needed. Especially with the sick stuff we later find out about Donnie. Disturbed people make friends with disturbed people. Now that's just food for speculation from moi. So we've gone over the early hours of May 31st. Let's go over the day. Brittany's phone location is unknown, at least to the public, but we do know that she got incoming calls and texts that went unanswered. And for the first time since Brittany had made a Facebook, she made absolutely no updates on May 31st, which is really out of character for her. She's on her phone and posts to Facebook constantly. As for Donnie, nobody really clarified his whereabouts the 31st. I do know that he started his day at Styx River and that between 8:30 a.m. and 7:06 that evening, he made 3 attempts to call Brittany and sent her 3 text messages. At some point, Wendy and the kids went to Styx River so that they could stay the night with Donnie, despite him not being allowed to be around minors. Either Donnie picked his family up or they might have gotten dropped off. Now, we do know Donnie started June 1st at the Styx River property, and sometime that morning, he took Wendy and the kids to Jennifer Moore's house. Just a refresher, Jennifer Moore was Wendy Holland's best friend. She lived in Magnolia Springs. Wendy and Donnie's family home is in Fairhope. Just to give you an idea geographically, from Wendy's home in Fairhope to Jennifer's family house is only a 25-minute drive, and both houses are 40 minutes from Styx River. Around 10:50 a.m., Donnie's cell phone pinged at a tower near Jennifer Moore's home. So I'm assuming the call was placed by Donnie shortly after he left Jennifer's house. Pause. Here's my thoughts so far. I'm assuming Donnie and Wendy likely knew he'd be arrested at his interview. So I doubt Donnie planned to just drop his wife off hours before his interview, which was to take place at 2:30. I think it's more likely they intended to spend as much time together as possible and were probably going to either drop the kids off at Jennifer's or all of them were going to hang out at Jennifer's and talk about the investigation before Donnie's interview, like strategize. It later came to light that Wendy and Jennifer are involved in Donnie's crimes. So with all this information, I think Donnie got into an argument at Jennifer Moore's home and he took off by himself. Donnie probably threatened to either tell about what happened to Brittany for leniency or maybe threatened he'd pin Brittany's death on Wendy. The possibilities are endless. So about 30 to 35 minutes after that call, between 11:25 and 11:29, Donnie called Wendy again, and he was at a cell phone tower near Karen's Court. I'm going to be honest, I know just about every location pertaining to this crime, except for where exactly Karen's Court is. It drives me crazy. If you know where this is, please holler and let me know. I'm on a need-to-know basis. But right after that outgoing call to Wendy, a few calls come into Donnie's phone, but he sends them straight to voicemail, probably because during 11:25 and that 11:30 window, Donnie said something to alarm Wendy, her friend Jennifer, and Jennifer's husband. And I say that because from 11:35 to 11:42, all three start calling Donnie over and over and over. And he did answer a couple of the calls, but not all of them. During this window of time where they're frantically trying to get a hold of Donnie because he took off mad, Wendy reached out to Detective Winberg, the one who was investigating Donnie's sexual abuse allegations. And she told Detective Winberg Donnie was behaving erratically and contemplating suicide. Reports are conflicting, but the podcast Uncovered got data and broke down Donnie's call records. So according to this outline of Donnie's cell phone records, at 11:46 and 11:50, Donnie missed 2 calls. One from Baldwin County Sheriff's Department and the other from Detective Winberg himself. I'm assuming Wendy called the detective and the detective called and reported it to the Baldwin County Sheriff Department. At 12:02, Fairhope PD created an incident report for a possible suicide likely near Fish River or somewhere else along County Road 32. So to put it in perspective, County Road 32 and Fish River is like a 15 to 20 minute or so drive from Jennifer Moore's house. It's probably 11 minutes to get to County Road from her house and then like another 8 to get to Fish River, if I'm not mistaken. In the Peacock documentary, Monsters in the Shadows, Chassie says the distance between where Wendy was and where Donnie was found is about 45 minutes. But after listening to the podcast Uncovered and mapping it out myself, the map the Peacock documentary and Chassie say don't seem 100% accurate. The distance was closer to 30, maybe 20 minutes. Not 45. No idea what made Wendy assume Donnie was at Fish River or County Road 32, but The bolo that was put out by the Fairhope PD says Wendy told them Donnie was probably in that area and that he was not armed with a weapon. According to Wendy, at 2:15, she stumbles upon her husband Donnie's car. He's in his vehicle, it's running, and he's got a gunshot wound to his head. He's gurgling up blood after attempting to kill himself. So his vehicle was at the end of River Road. It's sort of secluded, so I'm not 100% sure how she found him. I'm assuming they're super familiar with this area, though. Here's the thing, though. Yes, Donnie shot himself in the head, but he shot himself from behind his right ear and was still hanging on for life when Wendy found him. Despite that Donnie was still alive, Wendy did not call 911 or attempt to render aid. Instead, she had her friend Jennifer call Detective Winberg. So Jennifer didn't call 911 either. Jennifer tells Detective Wendy found Donnie and he'd been shot, but they didn't want to touch him. While Jennifer's on the phone with the detective, Wendy went through Donnie's stuff to find his cell phone and deleted 4 text messages off of it, of which nobody is aware of what they said. At 2:15, Donnie's cell phone received a call from Wendy's twin, Mindy, but it went straight to voicemail, probably because Wendy was using it. Between 2:15 and 2:27, a bunch of calls are made between Donnie's cell phone and Jennifer's cell phone, which is really weird because both the women are standing there together. They just found Donnie shot in the damn head. You'd think they'd call other people, not each other, but no, for 15 minutes they call each other off of those two phones. Paramedics made it to the scene and removed Donnie from his vehicle to transport him to the hospital before Detective Winberg arrived. So the same detective over Donnie's criminal investigation is now going to be looking at his gunshot situation, whatever's going on here. And that really doesn't sit well with me that he handled both cases. But anyway, Detective Winberg said that when he arrived, Donnie was being placed in the ambulance. And according to him, it is of his own opinion that Donnie's gunshot wound looked to be self-inflicted to the naked eye. So he just decided that was it. It was obviously a clear-cut suicide. No, he did not investigate the death or scene before ruling it a suicide. And because of that one careless or calculated decision, depending on how you look at it, everything goes to shit. Detective Winberg even admits, even though Wendy called him and not 911, would not render aid to her husband, and he could visibly see that she had disturbed Donnie's vehicle and the scene before police arrived, he still thought this was nothing other than a suicide. And when he later found out Wendy was using and deleting things off Donnie's phone, it still didn't make him think twice about Donnie's death because he assumed Wendy was deleting evidence pertaining to the sex crime investigation. In fact, Detective Winberg did not even seize Wendy or Donnie's phone at the scene. Wendy left with both phones and kept them for a long time without pause or question. But again, Detective Winberg said because he had an interview scheduled with Donnie that day at 2:30, he immediately thought obviously Donnie killed himself before he could be arrested and the world found out he was a pedophile. Okay, and I do kind of understand where that line of thinking comes from, but dude, come on. He's a detective. He can't just go off of a feeling for everything. Like, he didn't even test for gunshot residue, which is weird because the paramedics even bagged Donnie's hands to preserve GSR, but the bags were later removed at the hospital and not tested because police called the hospital and said, hey, we ruled it a suicide. We're not going to bother with the GSR testing. That's gunshot residue. Case closed. By the way, Detective Winberg, who investigated Donnie for sex crimes and his mysterious death, is only 23. Now, I don't believe in ageism. I don't think this would apply to all 23-year-olds, but I just think for him at 23 on a new job, new to all of this, this is a lot to take in. Okay, there's a lot of moving parts. That or there's possible police corruption. And I hate to think that way. But we will later find out Wendy is such a large part of Donnie's sex crimes. And by June 1st, Detective Winberg had to have been aware of her involvement. I mean, period. Remember, the two had met at 7 p.m. on May 30th without Donnie so Detective Winberg could question her. Then the day Donnie died, Wendy doesn't call 911. She calls the detective about Donnie during his meltdown and after she found him shot. Plus, there's a big gap of time between when Donnie left Jennifer's and was driving around and when he was found dead. This and the suspicious location of the gunshot wound is just too much to call this a cut and dry suicide. But despite all of that, police declared it a suicide and never checked Wendy's cell phone records, to my knowledge. Later, Winberg said in an interview, it wasn't common practice to bag and test for GSR in 2012. I think it probably at the very least was medical emergency protocol to bag a gunshot victim's hands to preserve GSR until they hear from the police if they want them to continue preserving it or not. If this wasn't any sort of police protocol, why would the hospital staff or EMT or whoever bag Donnie's hands to begin with? EMTs don't investigate murders. Hospitals don't investigate murders. That doesn't make sense. Now, mind you, at this point, nobody has any idea that Brittany ever went with Donnie or that she's missing. I keep calling Donnie's gunshot wound a shooting incident rather than a suicide because it's widely speculated that Wendy shot Donnie. This is partly because of the angle Donnie shot himself. So imagine, he has his head tilted like you would do if you were going to hold something between your shoulder and your ear. And he's sitting in the driver's seat of his car. His wrist wasn't up and straight, holding the gun aiming at his temple. It was sort of bent, like he was pointing the gun behind his ear. An extremely unusual way for someone to hold the gun to kill themselves. It's practically unheard of. And for this very reason, it's not 100% effective to end your life. You could slip and you could miss your brain, which is exactly what happened to Donnie. So he's taken to the hospital by EMT. Also, the gun he had was a 25 caliber weapon, not a large enough caliber that one would typically use for a suicide. Most adults choose a higher caliber weapon to aim and kill with no room for error. So yeah, that's why it's speculated if it was a suicide or a shooting incident. All local family meets at the hospital following this whole crazy ordeal. Donnie was essentially hooked up to life support. And it's said that while they were all in the room with Donnie, Wendy kept asking Donnie if he knew where Brittany was. And every time Brittany's name got brought up, Donnie's vital signs would go up, even though he was declared brain dead. This is what the family said, okay? And at the time, one of the siblings thought it was a little bit odd, but she also mentioned that Donnie and Brittany had a very unique bond. They were more like siblings than uncle and niece, and Donnie always looked out for Brittany. So with Brittany not answering her phone, it wasn't that irrelevant in context that she was being brought up. Again, unfortunately, nobody knew that she was actually missing and last seen with him. But again, it wasn't unusual for Brittany to be out of sight, out of mind for a couple days at a time. She was nomadic and had substance abuse issues. Okay, so this concludes part one. We've covered everything leading up to Brittany going missing and the mysterious death of her uncle Donnie. Part two, I'm going to discuss the timeline of events in the Brittany Wood missing person investigation and the criminal case pending against her family in chronological order so you can see how the two cases intertwine, and then we can discuss the final outcome. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to telling you the rest next week. Bye.